Hello, I'm Michael Cantrell, and you are listening to the Prison Officer Podcast, a place to have a conversation about the forgotten cops that work in this country's jails, prisons, and correctional centers. A place for me to try to make sense of a career spent working inside the fence with some of the greatest people that nobody sees or recognizes for the important job they do to keep this world safe. If you love this podcast, hit the follow button, or better yet, share with your family, friends, or coworkers. In more than 28 years of corrections, I have used or supervised pepperball hundreds of times. Now, as a master instructor for pepperball, I teach others about the versatility and effectiveness of this pepperball system. From cell extractions to disturbances on the rec yard, pepperball is the first option in my correctional toolbox. One of the most dangerous times for officers is during cell extractions. Pepperball allows officers to respond with the lowest level of force and still be effective and ready if the situation escalates. The responding officer controls where the projectiles are aimed, how many projectiles are launched, and how rapidly they're deployed. This allows the response to be tailored to the moment. To learn more about pepperball, go to www.pepperball.com or click the link below in the show's information guide. Pepperball is the safer option first. Well, hello, and welcome back to the Prison Officer Podcast. My name is Mike Cantrell, and today I am with a gentleman that a lot of you correctional officers probably know, but you didn't know that you knew him. His name is Larry Peebles. He's actually the author of The Correctional Officer's Prayer, which I've seen. Actually, I've seen it listed as unknown author. I didn't know who it was till you contacted me.
Yes,
and, sir. But it's been everywhere. I've seen it used at memorials. I know you'll tell us a little bit more about that. But you've had a long career in corrections, and I'm excited to get you here on the podcast and talk to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike, for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, I always kind of have the same format. I like to hear how people got into corrections and how your career built. So why don't you tell me about where you grew up and how your life started?
Well, here living in Florida, I'm actually a native Californian, and I left. My father retired from the military when we were in California, and so we moved to this little town here, at one stoplight at the time. But he retired from the Navy here in Florida, and he moved us, and I was 16 years old, and you talk about a culture shock moving from Southern California, where we were living in near San Diego.
Right.
To this little home, this little small town, you know, it was quite a culture shock. It was 76 or 77.
Right.
And here I am, a California boy with puka shells and a flowered shirt and long hair. And here I come to this little burg here. I was kind of like a fish out of water.
Sure.
So, yeah. So I finished high school here and went back to California for a couple of years, and it really didn't feel like home anymore. So I came back to Florida, and that was in April of 81.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated from high school in 79. And my father at the time was working at Union Correctional. It's the old Rayford Prison. They used to call it Rayford Prison.
Okay.
Okay, he was working there. He says, boy, go get you a job down the street, you know, across the river at FSP. And I said, well, okay, I'll go try it.
Uh-huh.
So I go in there and I get a job, and it's all good. And I stayed there for 10 years and did various things.
So what did he do?
Career,
what did your father do in the Navy before he retired?
He was a storekeeper. So
okay.
I had all kinds of good stuff, you know, Marine Corps knives and web, you know, coral shoes and all kinds of good stuff. He brought stuff home for me.
How'd he fall into corrections?
He had some former Navy friends or Navy people that told him, hey, go to Union Correctional, go to Department of Corrections. It's a good job and pays well, and it's a good retirement. So he went to Union CI and got a job there, and he worked at the warehouse. So he really wasn't an inside officer. He wore an officer's uniform, but he really wasn't. So he worked with mostly minimum inmates his whole career.
Sure. Okay. But that was kind of your introduction to corrections.
Yeah, that was my introduction to corrections. Yeah. So
tell me about going to work there. What was that like? What did you expect, and what did you find when you walked through that grill?
I knew nothing about corrections, absolutely nothing except what I've seen on television. And I walked through. If you know anything about Florida State Prison, it's designed. It's a central hallway, and one end of it is like 11 housing units on one end, and in the middle, what they call Times Square, that's intersect together. Okay. And then on the other end is the clinic, and it's about a quarter of a mile from one end of the hallway to the other end of the hallway. And the reason I know that is because I've run that before.
Sure.
From confinement up to medical, and from medical back to the confinement unit. And so the first day, they bring us out to the administration building. We fill out paperwork, and they tell us yada, yada. And so we're all walking in together as a group, and you come up to that first door that opens up, and you hear that motor, and you're like, okay, that's fine, that's cool. And it closes behind you, clang, and you're like, okay, that's going to be different. And then you go through another door, and then another set of doors. I was stepping through the gate, as I was saying, and I looked down in central part of the hallway, and what they call Times Square. And I look down the hallway and I see nothing but corridor and bars and blue uniform people marching in line and mopping. And it was like, okay, this is real. This is no BS. This is no movie. Mm-hmm. This is the real thing. And I'm like, okay, you got to make up your mind. You're going to do this or you're not going to do this. And I did think about it for a second, and I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I think I'm going to do this. I think I can do this. Yeah. And guy behind me, funny, because the guy behind me, he looked down that same hallway and he said, I ain't doing this.
Yeah.
I'm not doing this. Nope. I'm going back outside.
Glad he figured it out then.
And exactly, because I wouldn't want him to be the one to have to come save my butt. And he,
right.
So that was my first day walking around, basically taking a tour of the place. Mm-hmm. And it's Florida State Prison is designed where you have, at that time in 81, when I started, we had 6 open population wings. Each wing had 96 inmates.
Okay.
And then the remainder, 5 wings, was 6, 7, 10, 10, were confinement units. And at that time, our wing was just the only death row we had. We had some on S wing, but mm-hmm. mostly it was R wing, and that was 102 man cell.
Okay.
And then of course Q wing was the wing that stuck out on the end of Florida State Prison, and that's where the worst of the worst in the state and the death house was on the bottom floor of FSP there with the electric chair.
Sure.
And so that's when we were still using the electric chair. And so that's what we had. We had outside. We had towers, of course, guard towers all along the outside mm-hmm. perimeter.
How many tiers were these housing units, just so I can get it in my mind? Were they multiple tiers, 4 or 5, or was it 1 or 2?
It was 3.
3, okay.
3-tiered, and everything was on the second floor. Total of wings.
I'm
going to count here. J, K, L, M, N, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, 13 wings. Okay, 13. There were 13 wings, yeah. And
1,500 inmates?
1,200, yeah. Single man cells.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was full all the time. We had to, right. we had to, the Bluebird bus would have to bring in and bring out because we got to max. And at that time, the department was under a court order. We couldn't have so many over capacity and all that. So,
sure.
So that's what FSP was. Each wing was its own, basically within a wing. We had, like I said, we had 6 open pop wings. So we had about 600 inmates in open population.
What surprised you the most? What was the thing that was hardest to get used to stepping from civilian into being a correctional officer in there? Was it the violence? Was it the way the manipulation? Was it, what did you see that was most surprising for you?
I grew up in San Diego with a lot of gang violence, so I've seen people stabbed. So that wasn't really a problem. I mean, I haven't seen him stabbed 67 times like one guy did, but it is the constant working you. You as a if as an officer, they're trying to get something from you or work you or ask you questions about this and about that, trying to get a handle on who you are and how you are and what kind of an officer you're going to be. I mean, it's constant. And they all work on you. You know, it's all different people, but they're all working on you, trying to figure out who you are, whether you're going to give them what they want or whether you're not going to give them what they want or whether you're going to follow the rules or not follow the rules. So,
Yeah, I'll agree with that. That was the hardest. I don't think I'd ever experienced that level of manipulation, you know, and it was constant. I think that was the hardest thing on me. You know, new staff don't understand the value that's placed on information inside. So if they can just get tiny bits of information that gets sold around the institution to people who want to set you up or who want to manipulate you or get a little bit from you. And it may be nothing more than just, you know, your favorite NASCAR driver. Well, now that inmate that wants to manipulate you, he comes up and he says, "Oh yeah, you like this guy in the races, don't you?" And now you've got something in common. And I think that's something I wish they'd have talked to me more about. I mean, I made it through, but I wasn't ready for that. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
How was your academy?
Oh, well, back in the day, the old days, in 81, we didn't go to the academy right away. We were on OJT, on the job training.
Sure.
And I guess that's the department's way of saying, well, is this person going to make it? Well, am I going to waste any money on this guy before I send him to training? So I was on the job for almost a year before I went to training to learn about being a correctional officer. And by the time I'd done that, gone to school, I knew pretty much, you know, everything about that building.
Sure.
So they were just basically teaching me book stuff. Yeah. And of course, you know, it's important that you learn the law and, you know, the rules and all that sort of stuff. But back there in the 81 and 82, the Department of Corrections in the state of Florida added, and initially it was 160 hours. That was it, 160 hours, and you could be certified. And then 2 years later, they added an additional 160 hours of officer training. So in 83, I had to go. I worked 12-hour days. I worked 4 days at school, and then I went to the unit, and I worked the Florida midnight shift. And I did that for 6 months, trying to get the other 160 hours to be certified.
Wow.
So that's how they did it back then.
Yeah.
So, that's what we did.
Interesting. Now, in Florida, are correctional officers down there peace officers? Are you law enforcement?
You mean with arrest powers? Not specifically. I mean, we can arrest an inmate, but as far as going out to Burger King and or writing a ticket or anything, no, we can't do that.
Yeah, limited arrest powers. Yeah.
There's
a lot of talk about that going on around the country because more and more places, New Jersey, California, of course, have been ahead of that for a long time. You know, they have full police powers, full arrest powers. And then you've got other places where they don't have any. So I think that's a discussion that's coming to the head more and more these days is how we're going to go forward with correctional officers. I don't believe, I know for so long, and you saw this because it was your era too, but for so long they tried to make corrections part of law enforcement. Well, you're part of law enforcement, you know, and my vision is we're not part of law enforcement. We're part of the justice system. You've got, you know, judges and courts, you've got police officers, and then you've got corrections, and we're our own entity. And I think we need that respect for that, that own entity. So part of your, go ahead.
I always like to say that I always talk about first responders and all this other stuff. And I'm like, you know, that's great first responders. I said, but you never hear about correctional officers, first responders. And my answer to that is we're not first responders because we're already there in the middle of it. So we're not responding to nothing. We're there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we don't get the bonuses and the discounts and all the crap all that goes on the outside. So we don't have to worry about that.
Excuse me. So Death Row was one of the places that you worked there fairly early on?
Yes.
What was your thoughts about that? I mean, I dealt with some death row at Missouri State Penn, and it wasn't something I thought about before I walked through the door. And then you have to deal with the fact that, the state is mandated to take this person's life. Did you have any thoughts about that? Or
first of all, the potential for something to happen to you, to be killed anywhere would be death row, because what do they got to lose, right? What's another death sentence? They can only kill you once. But as a rule, the quietest place to work and the most not full of a bunch of stuff going on was death row, because they all had a television in their cell. They had a radio in their cell. They got canteen privileges every day. So they were pretty quiet and laid back, and it was a pretty easy duty. To be on death row, work on death row. Now, you always had to be, of course, vigilant. That's anywhere you go. But, we had some famous serial killers back in the day when I started, you know, Bundy and Otis Toole and Gerald Stano and Jesse Tafaro and people like that, you know, there. So, death row was one of the easiest, quietest places I worked.
Right. Did you ever move into being part of some of the executions?
Yes, I got to be, when you're a CO, you get to do death watch. You sit in front of the inmate cell down on the bottom floor queuing. It's called death watch. When they sign their warrant, they have between 30 to 60 days of when their warrant is active. And you have somebody sitting down there in front of their cell front monitor, it's called. And you sit there and you note everything they do. They eat, they sleep, whatever they do, you write it down, and you're there the whole shift. And if they go inside the prison to the medical department, you follow them, you go with them with the logbook, and you logbook and you log everything they do. And I've done that before, many times, sitting there in midnight shift or whatever. When I made sergeant, I got to be a van driver. I got to do with the grill gate monitor, which is the sergeant down on the bottom floor queuing who watches the officer. I also got to be part of the execution team. And my last job there at FSP for the last, I'd say about 3 years, was I had the keys to the bottom floor queuing. So I was the one who had all the keys to get in and out and from the front to the back of it. So I actually let the executioner in and walked them over to where they were, where they sat, waiting for the execution. They had what they call executioner's lounge. It's a little room with a couch on it. And so that's what I did for about 3 years, my last 3 years at FSB. I left there in 91.
Okay. Any hesitation with death penalty cases? I mean, or is that just... I know my own thoughts, but was that just a job? Is just what you were mandated to do, and that's the end of it? Or did you ever have any problems doing that, I guess? Thoughts?
No. They put themselves there, okay? And the law said that if they did certain things, heinous crimes, that they were going to die. Right. And it wasn't my job to judge them or whatever. It's my job to watch them. I'm not their savior. I'm their keeper.
Sure.
And so I just, whatever the law said was fine. And the irony of that, Mike, I don't know if you know this, probably don't. Later on in my career, my middle brother killed four people in California.
Wow.
And was on death row in California in San Quentin. And he was there from, 2001 until 2021. He was there for 20 years. He hung himself in his cell.
Wow.
He just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And people ask me, well, what about your brother? What about your brother? He's on death row in California. I'm like, you know what? My brother murdered four people. And if it was time for him to go, then it was time for him to go. And that's what the justice system says. And that's what the law says. And I love him and I'll miss him. But you know what? That's what it is. So I'm not going to be a hypocrite about it because it's my brother.
Yeah.
So,
wow. That's an amazing story right there to be on both sides of that. Yeah.
Yeah. My poor mother.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, Florida. Yeah, a correctional officer in Florida and a death row inmate in California.
Yeah, that's a hard line to walk there. Absolutely. And you have to face a lot of probably your own beliefs very bluntly, I would guess.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to look it up, it's Lewis James Peoples. That was my brother.
Excellent. So you mentioned you made sergeant. Were you, from the time you went in, were you looking at some point to go into leadership, or was that something that developed as you were in there and you started looking that direction?
Well, I wanted to be a sergeant, and because sergeants get all the good jobs. Okay. You know, I get to do pretty much what I wanted to do, supervise, walk around, and, you know, I'm not tied down in a particular area. And so, you know, I wanted to make sergeant. Everybody wants to make sergeant. And, should have stayed a sergeant. I made lieutenant. I said to myself, I should have stayed a sergeant. That was the best job I had, was a sergeant. So yeah, yeah. I did that in 85. I made sergeant in 85. And that's when I was able to join the CERT team, Corrections Emergency Response Team, which is like a SWAT team. So yeah. I was able to do that and do all the death house things. That's the rank you have to be able to do all that stuff. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah, I just talked a couple of episodes ago. I talked about being part of a team and how important that was to my career and how important I think it can be to other people's career. I tell rookies, you know, when you come in, as soon as you can get on a team, no matter what kind it is, do it. Because not only do you get the chance to get more training and have that camaraderie, but it keeps you focused more, having that group of guys around you. Tell me a little bit about being on a team. Would that mean a lot to you also?
Yeah, it was great. And for me, coming from California as an outsider, and it took me a while to get their trust, okay? Sure. But once they knew that I was going to be there when I needed to be there to take care of them and protect them, and then it was all good. You know, it didn't matter where I came from after that. I was one of them.
Yeah.
And so once I became one of them, one of the group, one of the guys, and it was great. I've never had closer a family than those guys, you know. I mean, we worked together. We went to riot squad training and CERT training and all kinds of different things together. We went cell extractions, and it was a good experience. And I miss some of those guys because some of them are dying. They're dead. They're gone. Yeah. And I miss them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, tell me a little bit about, you said you made lieutenant. Now, when did you leave Florida State Pen?
I left FSP in 1991, and I went down to Martin CI, which is down in Martin County near a little town called Indian Town. And it just opened up down there, and it was what we call in correctional slang the Wild West. It was a bunch of jitterbugs, and it was wild. It was, you know what I'm talking about. It's wide open. Stabbings on the rec yard, stabbings in the housing units. It was just a brand new place opening up, and they needed some experience down there. So I went down there, and I stayed there for 4 years.
Yeah, they open up those new joints, and that's usually when every other joint dumps whoever they're having problems with.
Exactly right. That's what happened. Yeah, I got stabbed twice down there, too. So, I mean, I've been stabbed before up here, but scalded, cut, you name it. But that's part of the job. So I stayed down there for 4 years, and the opportunity came for me to make lieutenant back in North Florida. And so that's where I went. I went up to Putnam Correctional, which is in Putnam County, and made lieutenant up there. And, you know, it was different for me. It was strange because I was always a line officer. And as a lieutenant supervisor, you have to think about your people all the time. You have to think about the inmates all the time. You're thinking about everything. You're thinking about chow. You're thinking about transport. You're thinking about this and that. You're always having to think about things that are going on. And it's a lot more responsibility. And, that's why I told you I probably, maybe I should have stayed a sergeant.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. But yeah, so I was a lieutenant. I came back up to North Florida after 4 years, I think. And I stayed at Putnam CI, I think, 4 years.
Yeah. It's definitely a wider view. You know, when you're young, and of course, sounds like we were kind of the same. You know, we start off as COs, you get on the teams, you know, you make sergeant, and you're running and gunning, and people are following you through the door. That's an easy type of leadership. And right. Then they didn't prepare me for the next step. You know, I thought it was just going to be more of that. And then you go up and you hit lieutenant and you hit captain, and it's this wider view. You have to have a bigger vision. Not just COs are looking to you. Everybody in the institution's looking to you. And I think I had some severe bumps getting used to that as I came up. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was different when you're standing on the side of the cell bar, of the cell bars, and watching them go in there, and you're having to say, okay, that's enough. Or, hey, cuff him up, or, hey, let's get him to the clinic, or whatever. You know, it's a little different than actually going there with the crew, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, you know, and we talked a little bit about the correctional officer's prayer. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? What was it that was in you that made you write that was going on at the time? Because I'm going to guess that was a time when you wrote that, when you were probably struggling a little bit, but I'm just guessing at that. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it was near the end of my career. I didn't go the full 25, but it's 25 years for a full retirement here. I didn't go the whole 25. I went 21 years and a few months. I'd had enough. I was starting to have some physical issues and things like mm-hmm. that. So I said, you know what? It's time to go. So I left at 21 years and a few months. And it was actually before 9/11. It was in 2001. It was in February, I believe. And I looked around on the internet, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, they got the police officer's prayer, you've got the fireman's prayer, you've got the teacher's prayer, and you've got this prayer and that prayer. And I'm like, you know what? There's no correctional officer's prayer. I've never seen that. I mean, I've seen somebody take the word police officer out and put correctional officer in, but that's not the same thing.
Right.
And so I wrote that prayer with the understanding of all the years and things that I've been through and all the people that I've met and all the inmates that I've seen and all the officers I've seen and what it means to go do a job, a thankless job, and to be able to come home after your shift, you know, to your family. And it just came together. It just came together. And it's been used, like you said, it's been used all over. It's been used in Australia and England and everywhere, you know. So I'm very happy.
Do you have that there with you?
I have a copy of it here. I have to refer to it because I.
Yeah, yeah. But for the people who may not have heard it yet, I think it'd be great if you were able to read that. I know. You could tell when, or I could tell when I read it, that it's written by someone who's been there. You know, that was the first thing I noticed.
Let me see if I can find it here. I had it up, but when this rural electricity went out here, it kind of screwed everything up here. Sure. Okay, hold on. Here we go. Yeah. It's coming up right here.
Okay.
Right. Matter of fact, last year, it was included in the memorial for fallen officers in the state of Florida. So it's a nice bronze plaque, and it's a really, really nice. Okay, it's Lord, when it's time to go inside that place of steel and stone, I pray that you will keep me safe so I won't walk alone. Help me to do my duty. Please watch me on my rounds amongst those perilous places and slamming steel door sounds. God, keep my fellow officers well and free from harm. Let them know I'll be there too whenever there's alarm. Above all, when I walk my beat, no matter where I roam, let me go back whence I came to family and home. That's it.
Absolutely. Amen. That's the way to end that. One of the passages there that gets me is, so I won't walk alone. And that's kind of been something that with this podcast and some of the writing I've been doing that I want to get out there. And we feel so alone. I've been there. I've worked that SEG unit. You work it by yourself. Sometimes, you know, it's midnights, it's evenings, and you kind of get lost in the work. And you're running those housing units alone, and you go home and you drive alone, and everybody in the house is asleep when you get home, and you do get this kind of loneliness. And it's interesting that you tapped into that. But one of the things I've just been trying to tell people is, you know, take a look around. And corrections is out in podcasts, books, more than ever before, you know. And I didn't know it till I started this podcast, but I've had over 70 countries that have tuned into the Prison Officer podcast. And
wow.
Before that, I never thought about that. You know, there's somebody in Israel that work in a jail. There's somebody in Singapore right. working a jail, Canada. Right. We've talked to Australia. We've talked to England. Mm-hmm. So we're not alone. We're doing the same job with the same thugs. They may have a different language or a different right. accent, but it's the same job. So I find that really interesting that you put that in there. And I think that's important for all of us to know that we're not alone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like we are sometimes because the press is so ignorant about what we are and who we are and what we do. They're just so ignorant. We're just a bunch of stupid guards. And what, yeah. You know, what do we know? You know, so that's one of the reasons I wrote the prayer and just to give us, you know, just to let people know, like you say, we're not out there by ourselves, you know, mm-hmm. And that people do care about us on the outside, our families and our fellow officers care about us and we're there to do a tough job.
Sure.
And we have a slogan, Jim Biardi and I, he's the president of the Florida PBA. And I came up with a slogan called "No Guns, Just Guts." That was us. Right. We did that.
Yeah.
It was an important thing, I think, to write, and a lot of people have responded to it, and I appreciate that. And it's up in Michigan at the Michigan Corrections Officer Slain Memorial yeah. there in Lansing, and it's a few institutions have actually put it into marble inside the facility, inside the little yeah. area before, you know. So I'm very proud
of it. I've been to a couple of different memorial services, you know, Correctional Officers Week, and I've heard it read there, absolutely. So I know it's something that is throughout corrections. You talk about, you know, the fact that the media and stuff. Tell me what you think about this, what your thoughts are. You've been around for a while. Corrections, in my opinion, needs to step out and start showing what we do. We've spent so much time hidden. We've spent so much time hiding the videos of what those inmates do inside, of what goes on inside, that the media has had this free rein to just fill it with whatever they want because nobody's countermanding them. They're not saying anything different. Right. We're hiding. Do you think it's time for corrections to quit hiding and come out and say, hey, here we are and here's what we do and we do it for you?
Does that make sense? I do, actually. I think it's time. And I think, you know, when you have those cell extraction videos, mm-hmm. Everybody's first thing they say is, oh, wow, you know, look at all those guys jumping on that poor defenseless inmate right there, you know. Well, mm-hmm. most of the time, that poor defenseless inmate has been ordered several times to cuff up, has been ordered several times to desist and quit doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And usually those kind are the disciplinary problems, you know, in the first place.
Right.
And those aren't innocent babes, you know, for talking too loud in church. And I think if we start putting it out there that we are there because we're doing what we're doing because they are the ones that are making us do that. I mm-hmm. mean, we'd rather be sitting around somewhere doing something else besides having to go into a cell. I think a more active role by some of the departments and maybe some of the corrections unions or whatever
right.
would be a good thing and get our story out there, you know, because you've only got stories like The Wire. You've seen The Wire on TV, right? The Wire right. on HBO, The Wire. And you've seen some of these other things that are just ridiculous, you know? So I think more positive role, more positive thing would be better. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know quite how we get that done, but I know there's a lot of people you know, taking the steps that it takes. Anthony Ganges out there and William Young doing just corrections. There's other podcasts and writing books out there. So I'm really happy about that. So tell me some of the other highlights about your career. What stands out with you?
Well, everybody asked me about Ted Bundy.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Tell me that story.
Yeah. Well, I knew Ted Bundy. He was just another inmate, like the rest of them. And he wasn't anything special. He was a quiet inmate. He didn't really give us any troubles. He did try to escape one time. He cut his bars, him and his cell partner next door. They did cut their bars.
What'd they use?
A hacksaw blades that were smuggled in from maintenance. Ah. Yeah. And but other than that, I can't remember anything that he did inside that prison that would have been given. He got a couple of DRs, disciplinary report, for when he went to medical. Sometimes he didn't like some of the things the doctors did or didn't do or whatever. But other than that, I was down on death watch with Bundy. And when all those guys, you know, all the guys that wrote the books and things about what Bundy told him, and I was sitting there, you know, with all of these guys listening to all this. I knew Ted Bundy. I mean, he was just like another inmate to me. I mean, so I did watch him die in the electric chair.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, really nothing to write a book about. It's just what I did, you know, at that particular time. Yeah. And I've seen about 17 or 18 executions.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, I wrote a book about J.C. Taffarel's execution in 1990. The sponge caught on fire on the head sponge caught on fire.
Right.
And so that was a messy one. But
The name of that book?
Oh, Execution Day Journal. It's on Amazon. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll put that in the notes. I didn't know that. I'll take a look at that.
I'll send you a copy if you send me your address.
Okay, that sounds good.
Cool.
Yeah, we'll put it in the notes so people could find it on Amazon.
Okay. My time on the CERT team, working with the SWAT officers, the Orlando PD, and we used to go out to Camp Blanding. They have a huge National Guard base here in Stark. And we'd all go out to Camp Blanding, and we'd work with different SWAT teams and things, and that was really fun for me. That was a good fun time with all my coworkers. And I was 24 years old, 25, 26 years old. So, you know, I was in shape.
Absolutely.
Not like that. If you can't see that, you can't see the little belly that I have here.
Yeah.
But so that was fun. Repelling and practicing snipers and things like that. That was fun.
Yeah. I've got a picture on the wall there of me rappelling. I don't think they make rope like that anymore. I don't think I'm going to trust a rope, but
yeah,
those were the days.
Yes,
hard charging and
you would Australian rappel down face down and you know all that stuff.
Absolutely,
when we weren't scared to do that and able to do it.
We still have a lot of great guys. I'll be going to the mock prison riot up in West Virginia here at 1st of May, I think, and watching that team competition up there. There's still some hard chargers out there doing some crazy stuff.
I've never heard of that. Is that a baton squad contest? What is that?
It's kind of like SHOT Show for corrections. At the old West Virginia Penitentiary. Teams from all over the country come there.
Moundsville. Okay.
Yep. And all the, you know, people who sell stuff, I go up there with Pepperball and I'll teach some classes. But it's a great time and it's great seeing all those correctional staff coming together and they get to spend 3 days setting up real scenarios and doing real things inside that prison Pepperball and everything will pass out Pepperball systems and let them go use them and see how it works.
Right.
And then they have a skills competition for the teams on the first day.
Okay.
And it's all running and jumping and rappelling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's cool. Fun to watch.
Yeah.
So what do you see for corrections in the next few years? What's I mean, we all know retention, recruitment, that's what everybody's talking about.
Right.
What are some of the challenges that do you still keep up with all this, I suppose?
I do to a certain extent. Every once in a while, when there's a particular bill in the legislature for pensions or for the current officers, I try to go up there and I do a little lobbying, you know, sure. with the PBA president up here, here in Florida. And you're getting more and more technical with some of the things that we're doing. Some of the defensive weapons and some of the cell extraction techniques are different. They're coming. They're changing. Mm-hmm. It's just not, you know, six guys run in and just, you know, however you got to get in, you got to get him.
Yeah.
It's changing and it's a new world, and which is good, which is fine. You know, mm-hmm. safe for the staff, safe for the inmate, even though he's a jerk.
Right. But, right.
you know, I see that technology becoming more part of the corrections job. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And technology is becoming part of the contraband also with drones and the cell phones. And
yes,
I was listening the other day and I think it was Senator Cotton. And I guess he's really trying to finally get some of this cell phone jamming going so that they can or not jamming anyway, where they take cell phone signals away from the whole institution, mm-hmm. not just an individual phone. So
right.
A lot of that's coming to light, and that's good to see. That's going to help them working inside.
Well, we didn't have cell phones back in the day. We had kite strings. If the inmates wanted to send contraband to each other, you know what I'm talking about? Kite strings.
I do. Absolutely.
Okay. Everybody who knows anything about corrections knows what kite stringing is.
Yep.
And they're very, very good at it. I've seen people move. My God. Pillowcases full of canteen items. I couldn't understand how they got it across the roof, but they got it across the roof and across this yep. roof and across that roof. Yeah. And it was amazing.
Yeah. That was one of the, back when I was younger and, we would, sneak down the pipe chases and try to pop out and just run down the range and try to grab up the strings, you know, and see what we got.
Right. Right. I like to get up on the roof and go up there with my little pair of scissors and I, you know, and they call me sure. six. They call me six kinds of whatever, and I get off the roof. But I'd be, you know, it'd be good. They wouldn't get their stuff because it fell in the yard. So
yeah,
just for fun.
So what are you working on now? You working on anything?
No, I'm just being retired. I just got married again. And,
okay.
Yeah. And
congratulations.
Just thank you. And I'm just living life with my new wife and I. We're just living here in Florida. And just kind of enjoying things. And we're both retired. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I'm doing. I just get up and then you just go, what am I going to do today?
So, there is life after corrections.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Yeah.
That's good. That's important. So if somebody wanted to get contact with you, you have an email that I can throw up on the deal?
Sure, I do. It's LEPKMP. @gmail.com.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate the conversation today. It's interesting hearing about all that. Thank you for writing that poem. Like I said, I know it's been used. I've heard it a dozen times in memorial services and stuff. It's always meant something to me. I know it means something to other folks. So I appreciate you doing that and appreciate you being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Mike, very much. I appreciate you. You're an awesome guy. I like your podcast very much.
I appreciate that. Yep. We'll try to keep it coming.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
I would like to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors that make the Prison Officer Podcast possible. Omni RTLS is a company that I've been working with for the last year. I am proud to be part of this team of correctional professionals who have developed the best real-time locating system on the market today. With Omni's real-time location technology, you automatically know the accurate locations and interactions of all inmates, staff, and assets anywhere in your correctional facility, and you have this information in real time. Omni is cutting-edge software for today's jails and prisons. It is the only way to monitor every square inch of your facility while still being PREA compliant. Go to www.omnirtls for more information and to make your facility safer today. That's www.omnirtls.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, the best way to support the Prisoner Officer Podcast is to share these episodes with your friends or family on social media. Let me invite you to visit www.theprisonofficer.com. If you haven't already, check out the Prison Officer Podcast on Facebook and click that little follow button, or leave us a message, or better yet, leave us a review. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify, please click the subscribe button. Till next time, I'm Mike Cantrell. Watch your back, and please take care of each other out there behind those walls.